It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. It's peak tomato time, so if you've got a pretty good haul and are wondering what to do with them all, stick around for Food Friday. We'll have some ideas and welcome you to share your own tomato-based recipes coming up. First, a Democratic lawsuit against the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission claims that the state's current legislative maps are unfair. The suit is asking a federal court to step in if Governor Tony Evers and the GOP-controlled legislature are unable to redraw legislative maps in a timely manner and wants to set a deadline for maps to be drawn. Republicans have responded by drawing up a plan that would allow them to intervene in that lawsuit. This all comes after lawmakers declined to use maps created by the governor's People's Maps Commission. We're talking now about redistricting, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts about the Democrats' lawsuit over redistricting? Do you think the courts should be involved in drawing our new political maps, or are you hoping to see some kind of compromise between the Republican-led legislature and the Democratic governor of the state? Call in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Robert Yablon is an associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School. His research interests include political and election law. Robert, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, all eyes are on new maps being drawn in Wisconsin and everywhere else in the country. Robert, why a lawsuit targeting the already existing maps?
Well, what happens when new census data is released is that tends to let us know that the districts that we've been using for the past decade are no longer equally populated, which they must be under the federal constitution. And so, every decade there is an obligation for states, for localities to draw new district lines. And this lawsuit, it wants a declaration from a court that indeed the maps that we've been using are unconstitutional. And it's basically, it rests on the premise that that the plaintiffs in this case don't expect the political actors in Wisconsin to actually pass a new map. And so they want to get a federal court started on that work.
Yeah, let's take this a step at a time. We've got the new census data just out now, and that sets the stage for lawmakers to start drawing a map. How is the process, in theory, supposed to work?
So the way that it is supposed to work, by law in Wisconsin, is that the legislature has primary responsibility under the state constitution to draw a new map. It's supposed to redistrict anew after a census. Of course, a census shows not only that the population of Wisconsin grew, but it grew unevenly. And so you now have some districts, especially in areas like Dane County, where you have too many people in the districts that there are now. So the legislature is supposed to set to work once they have produced a map. It goes to the governor for a signature. And that's where, we're expecting some difficulties this time around, because obviously the legislature is controlled by the Republicans in the state and the governor is a Democrat.
What has happened historically in these divided government situations? Lawmakers draw a map, governor doesn't like it and vetoes it. What happens next?
Right. You know, there are plenty of places around the country where actually you have divided government and both sides get together and they've been able to come up with a compromise map. That has not been the case in Wisconsin. Wisconsin had divided government after the 1980 census, the 1990 census, the 2000 census. And every time it did end up being a federal court that drew the new maps. There was an impasse and they just couldn't reach a compromise.
And that's the federal court. And we've seen some lawsuits already coming up. One preemptive one from Republican aligned groups asking the Wisconsin State Supreme Court to be ready to jump in early. Now we've got this Democratic lawsuit. What sorts out if the state court system or the federal court system is the ultimate decider here?
You know, this gets a bit tricky. Essentially, somebody needs to step up. And so... Ideally, I think there's a notion that it should be the political actors who do it. And federal courts really want to just be a backstop. And so the federal courts might see, do we think that there's a chance of a political compromise here? If not, does it look like maybe the Wisconsin state courts will act in an expeditious way? If so, then the federal court might sit back right? And see if the state courts will take action. But historically, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has been a little bit reticent to get involved in districting cases. And that's why in those previous decades, in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, it did end up being a federal court rather than a state court that did the job. But if our state courts really started moving quickly and there was interest at the state Supreme Court to hear this, this could end up being resolved by the state courts rather than the federal ones.
Now, one eventuality, and this is, I think, at the heart of this new lawsuit that started our conversation. What if nobody decides? Lawmakers pass their thing. Governor vetoes it. It's tied up in courts. All of a sudden, it's election day, spring nonpartisan elections or November partisan elections in 2022. What happens if no new map has been drawn by those election days?
Right. You know, this thankfully is rare. I mean, once it does fall to a federal court, the federal courts have been pretty good about respecting those deadlines and getting the job done. So, you know, in Wisconsin, really, some of the key deadlines are in April. That's the time when candidates in the 2022 election can start circulating ballot petitions. Those ballot petitions have to be filed by the beginning of June. And so the federal court is going to be well aware that something needs to get done by maybe probably, you know, March, the beginning of April at the very latest. Now, if somehow that didn't happen, then they may just say, look, for one more election, we're going to require you to use the old map, even though the old map now contains these unequally populated districts, just because there literally would be no alternative at that point.
We're talking to Robert Yablon, associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School, looking at how we draw our political maps here in Wisconsin, the redistricting process, new lawsuits, probably not the last lawsuits this time around. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Richard is with us in Rock County. Richard, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Richard?
Well, I would like to see someone who is not beholden to any particular political party, and I know that's difficult, but anyone that holds a political office right now should not be involved in making this. And I would hope that they would think more seriously about the Iowa plan that they use to set up there so that we don't have all the gerrymandering.
Richard, thanks a lot for the call. Robert, can you talk about what other states have done to try to have a less partisan lean when it comes to drawing these lines?
Sure. You know, there are a number of states now, a growing number of states, that have begun to take redistricting out of the hands of partisan actors and instead put it in the hands of folks who are meant to be a little bit more politically insulated and nonpartisan. In Iowa, they've had one of the longest established practices here, and they have nonpartisan civil servants who do the line drawing, and they do that without any political data. And there are a lot of reformers who like the Iowa system. You know, more recently, there are a number of states who have created independent commissions that are selected in various ways. And they are supposed to, again, work without reference to the political data that the legislators are often driven by when they make the maps. We haven't moved in that direction in Wisconsin, partly because we don't have a direct democracy mechanism. That's often been the way that this has happened in states. And, you know, the legislature is, for unsurprising reasons, reluctant to give up the authority that it now has to redistrict.
Richard, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Charlie in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I believe strongly in effective and limited government, and gerrymandering, it promotes the exact opposite. No matter what side of the divide you're on, by gerrymandering, you promote the election in the districts of the extremists of both parties. We need bipartisan compromising going on, and that can only be happening with fair and accurate districting and drawing the maps correctly, not so that it's gerrymandered. And I would like your guests to comment on how to get effective government with a correct districting in the, after the census.
Charlie, thanks a lot for that call. And Robert, that's a common criticism of gerrymandered district lines, that if you've got a sure thing Republican district, you're going to get maybe the most conservative Republicans. Same on the other side for liberal Democrats. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. I mean, I think the caller is identifying a real phenomenon out there. There's a lot of evidence to back it up, and it just makes intuitive sense that you have these dysfunctional political dynamics that arise when you get gerrymandering. And so there's a real unfairness to it. There are accountability problems that gerrymandering creates. That's one of the reasons why there has been pressure in so many states to move to other systems. You know, how could that happen in Wisconsin? I think that's one of the questions that the caller is getting at. There is no great mechanism to move from here to there in the state. You know, if it comes, it's going to have to come through political pressure and compromise. And the reality is that, gerrymandering is much more salient as a political issue than it was a decade ago. And with the kind of light that's being shined on the practice, that is going to mean that there are more political costs to doing it and more people that are going to propose alternatives. The governor, for example, has said that he wants the legislature to pass a law that would shift authority to a commission. And the governor himself has created what is meant to be a nonpartisan commission to propose a map for the state legislature and for Congress. But of course, the legislature is under no obligation to accept what the governor's People's Maps Commission is coming up.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. We're talking to Robert Yablon, associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School. He's talking to us about lawsuits over redistricting here in Wisconsin. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think would be the most fair way to draw our election maps here in the state? What do you want to know about the redistricting process in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. Is this an issue you've been active in? Going to meetings, lobbying politicians, calling your lawmaker? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with UW-Madison Law School Associate Professor Robert Yablon about a lawsuit over Wisconsin's legislative maps and the redistricting season. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now with Harry in Rochester. Harry, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that I find it sad that our elected officials refuse to do their job. We have systems in place, and these elected officials just fight and get nothing done. And what we need to do as citizens is elect different people. If they refuse to do their job, vote for somebody else. Get them out of office. Thank you.
Harry, thanks a lot for the call. The tall order there, Robert, as at least in theory, is with these gerrymandered districts, a lot of lawmakers are in safe seats, and it can be tough to change the representation there, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's what gerrymandering is meant to accomplish. It may be unpopular, but if it stacks the deck sufficiently in favor of the people who are doing it, they can withstand that unpopularity.
Thanks a lot for that call. You've mentioned other states where, Robert, isn't this independent commission, but you've seen lawmakers from different parties or, Republican legislature, Democratic governor, whatever the case might be, actually work together. Is there some sort of systemic thing that they have and we don't, or do they just play better together?
It may be a little bit more of the latter. I don't know that there are particular systems that they have that we don't that have made it happen, but it may just be more of a culture of compromise. In this state in 2011, the map that was created was a map that was substantially tilted in favor of the Republicans. That's what a federal court found in litigation, in the partisan gerrymandering litigation that was brought against the map. And so, understandably, from the legislature's perspective, that's not something that they're willing to give up. And understandably, from the governor's perspective, that's not something that he wants to sign off on. And so, that's when you get the likelihood of an impasse.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Bill with us in Gills Rock. Bill, hi.
Hey, thank you. This should not be a partisan issue, just like COVID, but it is, unfortunately. Anyone who's against having a bipartisan commission select these districts is really against democracy. So earlier, your guest said that the legislature doesn't want to give up its power. It's really the Republicans in the legislature that don't want to give up their power. The Democrats are all for a nonpartisan or bipartisan commission, which is a fair way, a democratic way to do this. So I just think we should call that out.
Bill, thanks for the call. Robert, what do you think?
Well, there's no question that that is the dynamic in Wisconsin, right? I mean, we are dealing right now with a Republican gerrymander. The map that was drawn in 2011 was drawn by the Republicans, signed off by Republican Governor Scott Walker. And so, yes, in Wisconsin right now, that's what we're dealing with. Now, it's I think, not fair to say that across the country, it's uniformly Republicans. There have been instances in which Democrats have gerrymandered when they've had the chance. But I think that by and large right now, if you look at things like congressional legislation that's being pushed, the Democrats are more likely than the Republicans at this moment to be pushing for these sorts of independent commissions and nonpartisan systems for redistricting.
Thanks for that call. And I dimly remember election reformers 10 years ago or so, or 12 years ago, being frustrated with Democrats who controlled the governor's office, the legislature in 2008 after the Obama election, and they swept Wisconsin. 2 years there where they controlled everything and didn't make a change, and obviously rued that after everything switched in 2010.
Sure. You know, when you're in charge, again, no matter who you are, it really does take a special sort of politician to be willing to give up that authority.
Let's go back to our callers now. David is with us in Ironwood, Michigan. David, hello.
A simple way to settle this all. See, it should require a 70% vote to pass any new redistricting. And that was ended. That will force the Democrats and Republicans to actually get together and get decent districts.
David, thanks a lot for the call. Robert, so a big supermajority, he's saying, in the legislature to pass new maps. Again, the legislature would have to vote to make that change.
So that's correct. There are some states that do have supermajority requirements, and the theory behind it is sound. It makes it more likely that, the only way to pass something would be if there was bipartisan compromise. The potential downside is it makes an impasse that much more likely. If it's hard sometimes to get 50% of representatives on board, it's that much harder to get 70% on board. And so you might ultimately make it more likely in that scenario that the task would fall to the courts.
Thanks a lot for the call, David. Dennis joins us now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Hi. A big problem is whether it's individuals or parties, there's so much prejudice that if somebody unpopular comes up with an idea, it's totally disregarded no matter what the idea is. Just like, for instance, I don't like Donald Trump, but I know Donald Trump had some good ideas.
Dennis, thanks for the call. And Robert, is that at the heart of the dysfunction here, the polarization that's making it hard to compromise on redistricting or insert issue here?
Right. I mean, polarization is an important part of this story, and polarization is both a cause and effect here. You know, polarization is one of the reasons why the Republicans in Wisconsin, Democrats in some other places so strongly want to gerrymander things in their favor. You know, they don't trust the other side to govern, and they don't want to work with the other side. And then once that happens, once there's a gerrymander in place, that can make the polarization that much worse. So it really can be a vicious cycle that we end up in.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about redistricting in Wisconsin, lawsuits related to redistricting. Robert Yablon is with us from the UW-Madison Law School. Back to your calls now with Walter in Fort Atkinson. Walter, hi.
Good afternoon. So here's my pitch. I would propose that an outside group draw maps on census data that's going to be available that are close to equal between Republicans and Democrats, and we know that's possible, and have those maps ready to go so that when the courts throw up their hands and get sick of the maps that they are forced to look at, they have this alternative. And the benefit of having equal sides is that the partisan politicians are forced to get some of their votes from the other side, and it makes everybody move toward the middle.
Walter, thanks a lot for the call. Walter's second point, echoing Charlie earlier there, Robert, but for his first point, is that in effect what Governor Evers is trying to do with that people's map effort?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that part of the idea behind the People's Maps Commission was to get a nonpartisan alternative out there, and not just a nonpartisan alternative in substance, but also one in process. And so I think the governor wanted to create a contrast with the open, transparent process that this People's Maps Commission is going to follow and what he expects we're likely to see from the legislature. And, you know, I would say I think that there are a number of advocacy groups out in Wisconsin right now, both partisan and nonpartisan, who are hard at work trying to put so that they will be able to submit to the court in this litigation and any other cases that arise and make the case that their map, which may well include competitiveness as one of the important criteria driving the line drawing decisions, that their map should be the one that the court chooses.
Walter, thanks for that call. Nancy joins us next in Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Yes, I just wanted to say, you know, what the effects of a highly gerrymandered district are. I ran for assembly several times, and the district I run in is, it looks like a salamander on the map, and it was specifically cut out to put a certain assembly person in there, and no matter what I did, including out fundraising this person, the outcomes were never any better than a 60-40. There was nothing you could do to make that any better.
Nancy, thanks a lot for sharing that story and the salamander, the animal that gave its name to gerrymandering in the first place. Robert, in just our last minute, we look at maps and see these weird shapes and they look unfair, but it's been hard to define what a fair map is. Republicans say, hey, wait a minute, Democrats are concentrated in big cities, so it's you really have to contort things to make it even. Is it possible to really draw fair maps?
It's a great question, and it's a hard question. And that's one of the reasons why the Supreme Court ultimately decided that it didn't want to get involved with trying to rein in partisan gerrymandering at all. It felt like it was too difficult to establish what the right map is supposed to look like. Now, I do think that even if you can't identify an ideal map, you can identify the ones that are extreme gerrymanders, right? You can sort out the worst from better ones. And what are some of the better ones? Well, some of the better ones are ones that at least try to strike a reasonable balance between what we would think of as traditional redistricting criteria. And some of those criteria are in tension with each other, and they include the idea that you want to keep local communities together, you want to have districts that are reasonably compact. And sometimes that might mean that you have somewhat fewer districts that are competitive, and so you might want to balance competitiveness in there. But of course, you know, when partisanship is your main criteria, you're not really doing any of those things that the districters really legitimately ought to be thinking about when they're drawing the lines.
Thanks again for that call. And Robert, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it. Glad to be with you.
That's Robert Yablon, associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School. His research interests include political and election law. We've been talking about redistricting season here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll get some ideas on how to use all those tomatoes popping up in gardens around the state. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, a state lawmaker joins the program for a look at new laws on police procedures here in Wisconsin. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now we're in the middle of August, which means it's peak tomato season in Wisconsin. Those tomato plants can be really productive, so if you've got more fruit than you bargained for, this edition of Food Friday is for you. And even if you don't have a haul from your own garden, maybe you just want to enjoy the flavorless fresh tomatoes from the farmer's market or grocery store. Our next guest has lots of ideas on how to enjoy them raw or cooked. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite kind of tomato? What varieties do you have in your garden? Are you overloaded with tomatoes right now? What do you like to do with them? A sandwich, BLT, salad, cook them down? Let us know what you do with your tomatoes or join in with your questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James Chen is the deputy editor for Taste of Home, which happens to be based in Milwaukee. James, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, I think we've all had the experience of staring down like a January tomato and knowing it's going to be rubbery and lifeless. Do you get excited when the fresh stuff starts to come along in Wisconsin?
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, I have been watching my tomato plants for like the last 4 weeks going, come on, you can ripen faster. Come on, come on.
What is your favorite way to use that fresh off the vine tomato?
Oh, to me, just doing as simple and little work to it as possible. The freshness, just chopping it up in a salad, just on a tomato sandwich, very simple is probably the best way that I like.
Do you have a favorite variety that you like to grow and or eat?
Not sure the name of it. It's a little yellow cherry tomato, which seems to just explode in my yard. And I have to fight the squirrels for it, so I know I'm going to get little seedlings popping up all over the yard in the spring. So that one has the best flavor that I've had.
And sometimes we end up with so many tomatoes, it's hard to figure out what to do with them. Apart from canning, which I know a lot of people like to do, do you have things you like to do to use up lots of tomatoes? Because like a sandwich is great, but you know, you can only put so much tomato on one sandwich.
Right. And so one of the things that I love to do with it is like a fresh pasta. So just tossing the tomatoes in fresh cooked pasta, and you don't really need to do anything with them. It is very, very simple. That is one great way to use them. I always toss them in like eggs when I'm scrambling them or an omelet. So there's a lot of different ways you can do that.
On a related note, you sent along a few recipes. We've got them links to your website at WPR.org/Food Friday. One of those recipes, a no-cook fresh tomato sauce. Sounds like it looks pretty easy. Tell us about this guy.
Well, that one is as easy as it comes. I mean, all you have to do is chop about 1.5 pounds of tomatoes, which is about 4 cups, maybe 5. I typically have a lot of basil growing, and I know a lot of other people do as well. So I just grab a handful of basil. The recipe calls for 1/3 of a cup. I usually go to about 1/2, maybe even a little bit more, and then olive oil. And you just toss that together with a little bit of garlic and let it sit for about 30 minutes. The juice is going to start coming out of the tomatoes, and it creates this luscious sauce that is just so inviting on top of really fresh cooked pasta.
And no cooking on that one, which on a 90-degree day sounds pretty good.
Yeah, all you have to do is cook the pasta, and there's some fresh there's some good pastas now that you can buy that are already cooked. So it is as simple as can be, and it is so delicious.
And the main extra flavor there you mentioned is basil, and that seems like such a natural pair with tomato. Are there other flavors, herbs, spices, you name it, that you think just match up really well with fresh tomatoes?
Fresh tomatoes really go well with rosemary, and so I've usually got a lot of that because that is my all-time favorite herb, and I use that in a lot of things. But fresh thyme is another good one, and an odd ingredient, you don't grow this, but curry powder. Curry powder and tomato is an amazing combination. So if you're making that fresh tomato pasta, that the no-cook one, then you could try spinning it a little bit with just a little bit of curry powder, and it just becomes something entirely different.
It is Food Friday, and we're talking about tomatoes with James Shend from Taste of Home, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite way to consume fresh tomatoes? Let us know if you have a favorite recipe, a sandwich, a salad, a sauce, a salsa, you name it. Call in now at 800-642-1234. If you're growing your own tomatoes, love to get your garden report as well. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, here's another recipe we've got that we've got linked to your website. And this is a good way to use a lot of tomatoes, a tomato pie. Tell us about this one.
Yeah. Well, the tomato pie is really good when you've got a lot of heirloom tomatoes that are a lot of different colors, because then it becomes this stunning, picturesque dish that you can serve. And it's great for lunch, for dinner. It's even really good for breakfast. And all you do is you start out with some cream cheese, some basil, marjoram, some thyme, and you make this filling that you can then put into this a crust, and then top it with heirloom tomatoes, some sharp cheddar cheese, some fresh cooked bacon, whatever you want. It's a really good foil to start things off, And so if you don't like marjoram or don't have it or thyme, you can switch up the herbs. Like I said, you can use fresh rosemary or just pack it full of basil. It is a really stunning dessert, not a dessert. It is a stunning pie.
And our own Bill Martins mentioned this on the show yesterday. He made this tomato pie. He gave us some notes here. He used up 3 pounds of tomatoes using 2 different varieties from his garden. One's red-green, the other yellow-red. Looked really good, major style points. And Bill says, make sure you get a lot of the moisture out prior to assembling and baking so you don't get a runny, gross pie.
Right. Right. So the key to this one is when I'm going to be assembling this, I'll slice the tomatoes and then I'll put them on a paper towel and just let them sit there while I'm assembling the pie. And then that the paper towel is going to absorb a lot of the liquid from the tomato. And so when you put it on the pie and it gets baked, it's not going to release all the water in the pie. Most of it has come out already.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Terry is with us in Mequon. Terry, hello.
Hi. I'd like to share an easy way to make sauce that I've come up with. Ooh. Because I didn't like peeling all the tomatoes. And I've figured out with the crock pot, and also it solved the problem of having just a few tomatoes at a time or whatever. And so I cut the tomatoes up, wash them, of course, but cut them up and put them in a crock pot overnight. And, of course, that cooks down into more of a sauce consistency. And then I put them through an old-fashioned food mill like you would make with applesauce. And that brings out the seeds and the skins. And then I freeze the remainder until the season is over. And then I thaw them all at once and add the other ingredients and cook it all at once. And then I do all my canning in one day.
Ooh, great. Terry, thank you so much for sharing that. No-peel method, James. What do you think?
I love it. We've actually got a marinara sauce on our on our website that you use a food mill. And I love cooking it with the skins and the seeds because I think it adds just a little bit more flavor to it. But then that food mill Terry was talking about easily pulls all that out. And it's a great way to do it. So I remember sitting there with my grandmother trying to dunk them in boiling water and then peeling. It's a pain in the chukus.
Terry, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I used to, James, can a lot of tomatoes, and yeah, I would blanch them, peel them. There was a unique tool. I just got rid of this because I haven't used it forever, a tomato shark, like a serrated melon baller. That made it a lot easier to pull out the top of the tomato.
Yeah.
Any other tips on if we are going to peel our tomatoes?
So one tool that I've gotten, and I believe it's from OXO, it's like a vegetable peeler, but it's serrated. And so it's got the little teeth on there. And that works really well for soft vegetables and fruits like tomatoes. It's excellent for peaches. You don't really need it for an apple, but those peaches, plums, those really soft fruits, it does a really great job in no time at all.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about our August tomato season and what we can do with the harvest. James Shend is with us, deputy editor for Taste of Home, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're gardening, what is your tomato harvest looking like so far? Do you have a favorite kind of tomato? What's your favorite thing to do with them? In a sandwich, a salad, a sauce, you name it. Do you have a question for our guest? Do you have such great quantities of tomatoes? You don't know what the heck to do with it all. Call 800-642-1234. Oh, and do you have a twist on the BLT? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. It's Food Friday. We're talking about all the tasty things we can do with fresh tomatoes this time of year. James Shend is our guest, deputy editor for the Milwaukee-based Taste of Home. We've linked to a few of their recipes using tomatoes over at WPR.org/Food Friday, and you can join it. 800-642-1234. Tell us about your favorite sandwich or salad or sauce that involves fresh tomatoes, and give us your garden report. While you're at it, call 800-642-1234. James, a classic, of course, with tomatoes is the bacon, lettuce, and tomato, the BLT. Lots of different ways to put together that basic combo. Do you have a favorite?
So I'm more of a purist usually. I stick to the classic. But when I'm wanting to like elevate it a little bit, avocado is an easy way to do that. I mix things into a mayonnaise, or I make a fresh mayonnaise with a lot of lemon, a lot of pepper to it. Some sriracha is also really pretty good. But you can switch things up. Instead of using iceberg lettuce, try bib lettuce, which is a really soft, delicate lettuce. Arugula is another one that really going to add a lot of peppery flavor to the BLT, and it gives you a little bit of different texture to it. But of course, the bread is also something you can play around with,
yeah.
Focaccia, ciabatta, things like that. There's infinite ways you can go with this. I've even had a beautiful BLT stuffed in a naan. So, I mean, there's infinite ways you can do this.
And you showed us another recipe. We've got it linked, Hasselback tomato clubs, like a club sandwich, I believe. What's the deal with those?
So this is another easy, no-cook way to do this, to serve tomatoes. And it's a very elegant presentation because you take the bigger tomatoes and you slice through them, but not all the way through. So what you end up with doing is like maybe 3/4 through, and you can actually bend the tomato and it fans out. And then in each one of those slices, you can stick some cooked bacon, some turkey, avocado, some Swiss cheese, switch up the ingredients, use whatever you have on hand. And it becomes this beautiful, just very easy, elegant luncheon or dinner that you can prepare like hours ahead of time. And it's just a really stunning thing you can do.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Eric is with us in Rice Lake. Eric, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Eric?
Good.
I got a great recipe. It's easy. It's quick. Take a tomato, cut it into chunks, put it in a dish, top it with Italian hot jardinera or hot pepper spread, and then sprinkle some fresh blue cheese or Parmesan or Romano on there. Let it sit for about an hour to marinate, and then eat it up.
Wow, that sounds good. Ooh. And super easy. And, Eric, you do this with fresh tomatoes in August? This is something you might eat this weekend?
I had some this morning.
Excellent. Great breakfast. Breakfast of champions. James, that sounds pretty good to me.
That sounds so good. I could even see putting that on top of like an omelet or like cooked chicken breasts or things like that. That is a stunning salad that could go into so many different ways.
Eric, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Poking around on the Taste of Home website, James, there's, I don't know, like 1,000 or so tomato-related recipes. I believe I saw a couple of them that put tomatoes on the grill, just briefly, but it gets a little char on the tomato. What do you think of grilled tomatoes?
Grilled tomatoes are really good. It's a great way to kickstart a sauce if you wanted to do it. But what you can also do is if you're grilling the tomatoes, go ahead and take your lettuce, especially if it's like a romaine, cut that in half and throw that on the grill for about 30 to 40 seconds. And you have this grilled romaine and grilled tomato salad that is just amazing.
Awesome. Let's go back to our callers now. Tanya is with us in Viroqua. Tanya, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had to call in and tell you a story. Years ago when my kids were little, we stopped at the co-op, one of the co-ops in Minneapolis, and they were doing a taste, you know, a little tasting sample, and they had fresh tomatoes with sourdough bread, and it was the most delicious thing we ever had. So ever since then, and my kids are all grown up now, ever since then, the epitome at the height of summer is for us to get a loaf of sourdough bread, slice it, toast it, you just put mayonnaise on it, the meatiest tomato you can find, slice of that, salt and pepper, and we just eat it open face, and it's been our go-to in the middle of summer every year since my kids were little.
Sounds fantastic, Tanya. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, something about mayo and tomatoes, James, works really well for me anyway, and obviously for Tanya. What do you think?
Oh, I love it, and I'm a big mayo fan anyways, but tomato and mayonnaise is just a really good classic combination. And to Tanya's point, it's like if you go anywhere in the South, that is the classic dish that they serve in the summertime. It's not even really good sourdough bread. This is just plain white bread, a big slab of tomato, a lot of mayonnaise, salt and pepper, and you're done. And it's like basically just roll up your sleeves because you're going to get wet. And it's such a delicious sandwich.
Thanks a lot, Tanya, for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We got an email from Grant who suggests replacing the bacon in the BLT with, quote, finest quality of smoked salmon, end quote. So an SLT, a salmon, lettuce, and tomato.
Oh, I like the way he thinks. That sounds really good.
That does sound good. Thanks so much for sharing that with us. Let's go now to Doug in Colfax. Doug, hi.
Hello. My wife and I do a fairly large amount of tomatoes, and so she cooks them in a Nesco roaster and then uses a hand mill to get the peel, the skin off, and she gets through a pretty high volume of them that way. We can about 50 quarts, and it goes in everything from spaghetti or chili to whatever.
Sounds fantastic, Doug. Thanks a lot. And there's that millet to get the skin off after instead of pre-peeling it, James. I like the way these people are thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great way to use an old tool. I mean, it's something every single grandmother and person had. And it seems to have gotten out of the way or out of favor, but I'm like, I love it. I still have my grandmother's and I use it all the time. It's great for even mashing potatoes.
Thanks for that. We're talking to James Shen with Taste of Home, talking about how we can use our big tomato harvest this time of year. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jack is with us in Wauwatosa. Jack, hi.
Hi there. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
What do you do with your tomatoes, Jack?
I like to take the small ones, as your guest described, too, especially the little yellow ones, and you put them all on a spear, like a wooden spear that you would use for shrimp, and then grill them, and then with olive oil, a little crushed red pepper, and then the final thing is you put over a balsamic glaze.
Ooh.
Wow.
All right. That sounds really good, and that's something you just do on, you could just use like a normal grill skewer, couldn't you?
Sure, you could use any kind of skewer, metal or wood. The wood ones work well because if you soak them, you can actually soak those in a little wine for extra flavor.
Oh, wow. That's great. Jack, thanks a lot for the call. And balsamic. Now, I don't always think of, you know, vinegars and things like with tomatoes, James, because it's an acid and an acid. What do you think?
I like it because the fresh tomato tends to be a little less acidic than you see in canned tomatoes. But the balsamic is a classic combination with that as well because it has a little less acid than other vinegars, and the flavor is just great with the tomatoes. So I'm a big proponent of it.
Thanks for that call. Larry joins us now in Green Bay. Larry, hi.
Hi. Glad to be on the show. What I do is I take some onions, saute them in olive oil, get some fresh sweet corn from a local market, peel it off the cob, cook it up together with some salt and pepper and toss in some onions, and it's just a great dish.
Oh, that sounds really good. And I love tomatoes and corn. Just maybe it's because they're always together. I remember having tomato sandwiches and corn on the cob as a kid, like tomato and cheese sandwiches, and that was a full meal. And they work together really well in salsas too, don't they, James?
They do. They work really, really well together. Another summer staple that works really well with tomatoes, and it may sound odd, but you've got to try it, is watermelon. Watermelon and tomato, just turn that into a salad with a simple vinaigrette, and it is unbelievable. Great summer salad.
Huh. Awesome. Thanks, Larry. Time for one more caller. Karen is with us in Rice Lake. Karen, hi.
Hi. My brother doesn't really like lettuce, so he has onions on his BLTs in place of the lettuce, and it's really good. We all enjoy it.
Awesome. Yeah, I think onion and tomato on a sandwich is great. James, we're just about out of time. One last thought on using up our fresh tomatoes.
There's an infinite number of ways. I mean, there's so many ideas that come to mind, but I just have them sitting on the counter and we snack on them. And it's like my whole family will just walk by because I usually have a truckload of the cherry tomatoes. And, like, we don't have candy in the house. It's just people are walking by, and they're picking up the cherry tomatoes and just popping them in. It's the best, easiest way to do that. Again, salsas is a perfect way to use up a lot of that, and you can can that as well. There's a lot of great recipes online, especially the tasteofhome.com. We've got a number of them for that.
James, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much, and I hope everyone enjoys the rest of their summer.
That's James Shen, deputy editor for Taste of Home. We talked to him about tomato season. We've got a link to 3 tomato recipes at the Taste of Home website. You can find those links at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday on Central Time. It's always been tough to work in customer service. The pandemic made things even worse for a lot of people. Find out why people treat service workers badly and how we can turn things around. That and more Monday on Central Time. Are you looking for some great exercise? Something that gets the heart rate up for an extended period of time and burns lots of calories along the way? Look no further. Try getting into chess. As reported by ESPN a couple years ago, but I just saw the link to it today, chess can be a big calorie burner, at least for elite players. One chess grandmaster was fitted with diagnostic monitors during a tournament. It found that he burned 560 calories in 2 hours. Of chess. And a Stanford researcher estimates that a full day of tournament play can burn up to 6,000 calories. That's in the neighborhood of 3 times as much as a human uses on a normal day. What's going on? Well, it's all about the stress and concentration, apparently. The constant focus and mental activity is a big calorie burner, and it can lead to boosts in breathing and heart rates, just like exercise does. It's common for top-level chess players to lose 10 or 15 pounds over the course of a tournament. A lot of top chess players have taken on physical training regimens like elite athletes do in a lot of sports. Doesn't sound like the best way to lose weight to me. And let's be honest, my board gaming involves a lot less mental concentration and a lot more snacking. Exercise news you can use. This is Central Time.